Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We started the week in Athens. We will end it back home. We will wrap up the 5 days gone by today. Also, the economics of happy hour and a book about the conservative heart from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday, the 17th of July. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. We are going to get right to it. So much news, so little time. John Carney is here to do our weekly wrap with us. He is with The Wall Street Journal. Lee Gallagher is here as well. They are both in our New York studio. She is at Fortune Magazine. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so let's do a short-ish round on Greece. I want to know, because we did a bunch of it earlier in the week, as you guys know, I was over there. I want to know, in light of this bailout, John, and the continuing situation over there, do you think we will be back at this same spot in, I don't know, 18 months?
Of course we will.
Thanks for coming by. Let's move on.
There's no doubt about it. They need far more serious debt relief for this thing to stick. They just will not be able to afford the deal that's on the table now. I guess it's a good sign that, you know, they want to keep kicking the can down the road, but it's not going to end. And we're going to be talking about this for the next year, and then it's going to happen again.
You said the word. All right, Lee, what do you think? Are we back here in a year?
Yeah, I agree. This doesn't get wrapped up in a bow. I mean, all the money that's going to Greece, that has gone to Greece, it goes to pay international loans. It doesn't even stay there. And they need a recovery. They need, you know, it's like Mark Cuban says, sales cures all. I hate to combine Mark Cuban and
that
Greece.
Was, holy cow. I don't
but it applies to everything. It applies to everything. And it just, they don't have it.
All right. Fair enough. Let us take a very brief detour to China. John, before I left for Greece a week and a half ago or a week ago, lots of consternation about the Chinese stock market and the government intervening and what it says about the underlying economy. Which are you worried more about, China or Greece?
I am much more worried about China. I think the world has the ability to withstand a pretty bad meltdown in Greece, but not at all in China. The global demand from China is absolutely necessary, not just to the U.S. economy, but economies all over the world. And if that place melts down, we're in a lot more trouble.
Lee, same question.
I agree. Yeah. China touches everywhere. I was just in Africa, and China is everywhere
in Africa. Yeah.
So it's much bigger problem.
Yeah. The corporate story of the day, the corporate profit story of the day is Google. Lee, shares up 16% today. It added like $60 billion to its market cap. What is going on there?
A couple things. I mean, Google outperformed. It struggled over the past year. There's a lot of things happening that Google has had some issues with. But, so I think investors were pleasantly surprised. Yeah. It was also the first quarter reported by the new CFO, Ruth Porat. She didn't have much to do with the results, but she really communicated some things Wall Street wanted to hear. Specifically, she's going to control costs. She's going to be more open, more disclosures. All of this was incredibly reassuring. And I don't want to say it takes a woman, but, you know.
but okay, we'll just let that land there for a minute. Speaking of women, John, I want to talk about Janet Yellen. Gave her, semi-annual congressional testimony. Said basically, we'll raise rates when the data tells us we can raise rates. Everybody relax. But there was some pushback on banking regulation and this whole systemic issue.
Right. One of the things that was most interesting is, at least in the Senate, they were a lot less focused about rates raising and when that was going to happen. That seems to be they're fine with that. But they grilled her pretty hard on whether or not the Fed was willing to hold banks to the legal requirement that they have these living wills that would allow them to be resolved without it collapsing the economy. And it came not just from the Democratic Elizabeth Warren side of the aisle, but also from Bob Corker on the Republican side. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely bipartisan pressure that is, I think, raising the risk to the banks that the Fed is going to feel like they have to actually hold at least one of them accountable and maybe make a sort of sacrificial lamb out of them in order to show that they're serious about this, because it's clear that the senators do not believe that the Fed is willing to really push the banks hard on this. Bob Corker even used the word regulatory capture.
Ooh,
and, you know, say the banks are running the Fed on this.
John Carney at The Wall Street Journal, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
All right,
thanks.
We'll see you. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, traders had a, you know, good enough day today, I suppose. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It was news of the housing market that got some attention this morning. Double-digit increases in housing starts, new construction of housing. Turns out there was a whole lot of statistical noise in that number, but as often happens, the real story was in the details, containing a bit of actual good news on the housing front. From Washington Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
If you walk past a shop of economic statistics, you see a nearly 10% jump in housing starts in the window. That is a shiny object. So you go in. And then the fine print says, well, the increase in new home building in June was entirely in apartments and condos, which create fewer jobs, and largely in New York State. Economist Stephanie Carroll at IHS says there's a tax break going there,
which incentivizes builders to put up large apartment buildings. That was set to expire on June 15th.
Okay, a New York stampede does not a recovery make. But while we're shopping here, may as well look around. And whoa. Building permits, highest in 8 years. Single-family housing starts, up 43% this quarter. First-time homebuyer purchases, up nearly 30%.
That's new blood entering the marketplace. That frees up some of the older buyers to then turn around and say, hey, I want a new house. I want to build the house that I've always wanted.
She calls this a housing recovery gaining steam. Still, Vishy Tirupatur at Morgan Stanley says comparing today to the frothy housing days of 2006, well, we're nowhere near that. We're not even back to the pre-froth days of, say, 2003.
While we are getting better than last year, but we are quite far from what would I consider to be a more normalized housing market.
He says the key to the next level of recovery is unlocking more credit to more people. Yes, mortgages are affordable. They're just not available enough. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
It's been a rough couple of weeks for Reddit, the online message board and news site and jack of all internet trades, really. There's about a million ways to describe the thing. The reason I'm bringing it up, though, is because Reddit, the company, has an old is new again CEO. Co-founder Steve Huffman is back in charge. Interim CEO Ellen Pao stepped down last week after what you can only call a revolt by some Reddit users and volunteer site administrators over some of Pao's management decisions. Reddit has become, in the years since Huffman left, one of the world's most popular websites, thanks in no small part to content that is really anything goes. But it is precisely some of that content that leaves advertisers in a bind. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
A lot of people know Reddit through its Ask Me Anything channel. Even President Obama's held a chat there. David Pakman, a venture capitalist at Venrock, says Reddit's footprint is enormous.
It's about a top 33 site on the internet today globally, top 10 in the U.S. It attracts like 165 million unique visitors a month. It's really one of the largest media properties on the planet.
But it has fewer than 80 employees, with thousands of unpaid volunteers who supervise the site's content and message boards. That's creating a challenge for the company. Internet entrepreneur Ben Huh says Reddit's been the place where you can find the seedy underbelly of human desire.
You know, you have people who have creepy predilections or are racist or are sexist or just plain old trolly and rude.
Last year, Reddit only brought in $8 million of ad revenue. So one of new CEO Steve Huffman's top goals is to ditch the dirt and court the cash. The trick, says Huh, is to attract advertisers while preserving Reddit's brand as the place where it's safe to have an open, authentic conversation.
When you do decide to change things on a site like this, then you have the credibility of authenticity. You're not coming in and saying, I'm doing this for my own benefit. The users have to believe that the greater good here needs to get done.
That's why one of Huffman's first steps as CEO was to host an Ask Me Anything yesterday with users. During that open conversation, he proposed new content policies, like banning bullying and illegal activity, and making it harder to find adult-only content on the site. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Banks do a lot of things. Checking and savings accounts, yes. Investment and asset management, also yes. Those are pretty standard services. What about a little genealogy on the side? Wells Fargo has a team of historians that'll put together family histories for the bank's wealthier clients. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains why that makes business sense.
Judith, good to see you.
Come in.
Judith Alter Kallman has a fancy New York City address with fancy art in fancy gold frames on the walls. Wells Fargo chief historian Andy Anderson spreads documents and maps of countries that no longer exist across her coffee table.
This is the ship manifest for the passenger ship SS Kroonlin.
In 1904, Judith's father-in-law, Harry Hirsch Kallman, first stepped on American soil. He was about 20, a baker with brown hair and gray eyes.
That was the beginning of the family story here in America.
In tiny little handwriting, the manifest even records how much money Harry had with him when he came to the U.S.
And he wrote...
What did he put down?
$20. Fast forward a century, the family now has enough wealth to be considered among Wells Fargo's top clients. Andy says documenting this history for the Kallmans helped deepen their relationship with the bank. But he also does this for new and potential high-wealth clients, even some companies.
In particular, with multi-generational families, it's not uncommon to see actually a doubling of the assets under management that we have after we do this.
So Wells doesn't charge for these histories. It thinks they more than pay for themselves. But genealogy has become big business for many other companies. Among the biggest, Ancestry.com did $620 million in revenue last year, nearly triple what it was in 2009. People want to know where they've come from. For Judith, this was more than just a hobby.
I never have had a record. My parents died when I was very young. I mean, they were killed in camp.
She lost her parents and two siblings during the Holocaust.
And I needed that sense of belonging, knowing where I came from. And I had to pass this on to my children. Don't get involved with the wrong crowd, with the wrong people. You come from a wonderful foundation. You come from a heritage that is special.
And Andy says that's a big part of this for Wells, helping people teach the next generation where all that money came from and the values and hard work it took to create it.
History is always about the future. If you just take a look at the reasons why you were successful previously, they're the best signposts you'll ever have as to how to be successful going forward.
He tells customers, consider your past to plan your future. After all, Wells is in the business of creating and preserving wealth. They don't want that money going anywhere. The more they manage, the more they make. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It sounds like both parties are trying to convince their base that if they vote for the other side, it'll be the zombie apocalypse.
Zombie apocalypse or presidential election season. You decide. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 33 points today, nearly 0.2%, 18,086 on the blue chips. The Nasdaq gained 46 points, 0.9%, finished at 5210. The S&P 500 picked up 2 points, 0.1%, 2126 for the week that was. The Dow up 1.8%, the Nasdaq jumped 4.3%. Hello, the S&P 500 added 2.4%. Google, as I said, up 16% after reporting profits yesterday, and call this the Google effect. E-commerce site Etsy picked up 30% today. 30%. The company was mentioned in Google's quarterly call yesterday. Amazon up 1.5%. eBay up 1%. Bond prices rose as well. The yield on the 10-year Treasury down to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, President Obama is scheduled to meet with the President of Nigeria at the White House. The United States Embassy in Havana reopens after more than 50 years. And in need of a little Christmas cheer, head to Denmark, where the World Santa Claus Congress gets underway. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Season's greetings.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. From the pages of the Wall Street Journal today, this item. The paper says Hulu, the video streaming service, might be launching an ad-free option. It would come for a fee, of course. Hulu's not commenting, but if this does pan out, that is, charging people more to watch TV without ads, it would make Hulu another one of the many digital companies letting us buy our way out of ads, which we'll go over with marketers exactly how, do you suppose? Marketplace's Adrienne Hill is on that.
If I want to watch the latest creepy episode of Wayward Pines on Hulu, I have to suffer through this upbeat ad for breakfast biscuits.
Made the bed, had a swim, scared the pants off of Tim.
I don't eat breakfast biscuits. I'm in the mood for something dark, and I'm paying Hulu $8 a month. Talis Tashura teaches marketing at Harvard Business School.
Too much ad clutter makes some people say, I don't want to be exposed to all these ads, and they go to a competitor.
That can hurt services like Hulu when there are so many other ad-free places to watch TV. Netflix, Amazon, HBO, YouTube is working on a paid ad-free model. Our ability to buy our way out of ads is a problem for advertisers. Lars Perner is a marketing professor at the USC Marshall School of Business.
The people you're losing here through opting out from advertising are some of the most valuable customers.
The people who can afford to opt out, the people with disposable income, are the people in the market for a Lexus or an expensive new gadget. But Steve Kazajian, who's the head of the television marketing organization Promax DBA, he's not worried.
You will be able to buy yourself out of a 30-second spot. You'll never be able to buy yourself out of being marketed to.
Nothing sinister, he says. It's just the world we live in.
It's not like Dr. Evil, you know, with a white cat on his lap.
Marketers, he says, are getting smarter about targeting ads, making them more relevant, and making their brands part of the shows themselves. Also, that data you turn over when you opt out, they can use that, too, to get a better idea of how to market to you somewhere else. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
You'll find the American Enterprise Institute right at the top of the list of influential conservative think tanks, and therefore, almost by definition, you will find one Arthur Brooks, the president of AEI, at the top of the list of conservative political thinkers. To that end, Brooks has a new book out. It's called The Conservative Heart, in which he shares his thoughts about how conservatives can break away from the usual stereotypes that a whole lot of people have about conservatives. Mr. Brooks, good to have you on.
Nice to be with you, Kai.
I guess the first thing I need you to do for me is tell me how the conservative heart, the theme and also the title of this book, is different than compassionate conservatism, which is the last thing most of us remember.
Yeah, well, compassionate conservatism was a salient theme in the Bush administration. And what it assumed was that conservatism is not inherently compassionate. And that's something that I reject. Now, I know that there are a lot of conservatives who are not very compassionate, just as there are a lot of liberals who are not very compassionate.
Okay, so how come, and you admit this freely throughout your book, how come conservatives get such a bad rap on the compassion thing?
Well, the biggest reason is because of the way conservatives talk. I've been in the public policy business for a really long time, and I've talked to a lot of political conservatives, and their opening bid tends to be, hey, you know, conservative politics, they might not, it might be not so great for the poor, but it makes the whole country richer and that could lift everybody up, as if this were really about the money. And it isn't about the money. It's about dignity. It's about freedom. It's about work and all the things that we really care about. If we can actually have a competition between liberals and conservatives to talk about how we can serve the least of these, our brothers and sisters, just a little bit better, I think that would be an inherently compassionate thing to do. It'd be a good competition.
The last chapter of this book is basically a training session. It's pulled from training sessions you do with members of Congress. right?
Yeah.
Where you take them and you say, listen, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. It does sort of seem like conservatives are their own worst enemy.
Well, you know, people in public life have tended recently to be their own worst enemies. We're going into a presidential election. I guess that's not news to you, Kai, but it's bad news to a lot of Americans. And the biggest reason is because it looks like it could be another election that's about competing pessimisms. Mm. You know, it sounds like both parties are trying to convince their base that if they vote for the other side, it'll be the zombie apocalypse. It's horrible.
Since you brought up the election, I'm going to throw four words at you technically. Tea Party, Donald Trump. What do you do with those if you're a conservative? Seriously, trying to establish compassion as a calling card.
Well, the Tea Party is in the process of trying to transition, at least leaders of the Tea Party, from a protest movement to a social movement. And that's going to require not just fighting against things, but fighting for people. Protest movements always fight against things, and they can get a lot of energy and be very successful doing that. But then fighting for people is what social movements do, and that's a pretty important transition. And the Tea Party is in that transition. Whether or not they'll be successful is another matter. Donald Trump is a phenomenon of an election campaign that has a whole lot of media. People that want to build up what's effectively a political sideshow into something else. There's nothing that I regret more than somebody calling himself a Republican who is effectively anti-immigrant. I think it's destructive.
Let's say you get to run, I won't say the Republican Party, I'll say the conservative party in this country for the next 10 or 15 years. What does it look like by the time you're done with it?
Believe it or not, I'm not even a registered Republican. And part of the reason is
don't say that out loud, man. People aren't listening. You might get into trouble.
Well, I run a nonpartisan organization and I have politically conservative views.
Technically nonpartisan, right? I mean, come on.
No, I mean, it really is. We have Democrats and Republicans here, and especially among young people, that's certainly true.
All right.
You know, what would a conservative party look like? It would be a party that's animated fundamentally by optimism. The truth of the matter is that a pessimistic view about the way the country is going doesn't match reality. I know certain things are wrong, but child mortality is down. Literacy is up. Public health is better. People are living longer. This is a great country. It's a beacon of hope for the world. So what I want conservatives and liberals too, by the way, is to be more optimistic and compete with each other on the basis of optimism. So if I were running one party or the other, that's the direction I'd go.
It's a book called The Conservative Heart by Arthur Brooks. He is the president of the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Brooks, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai. It's great being with you.
It's Friday. End of the work week. Maybe you'd like to go out for a beer or two, hit a happy hour perhaps. That'd be fine unless you live in Maine, Massachusetts, or one of the 9 other states where 2-for-1 drinks and dollar beers and the like are against the law. Illinois was, until this week, a member of that moderation club, but the happy hour ban passed 26 years ago in part to curb drunk driving and binge drinking has been lifted. And you can almost hear the carousing from here. Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports from Chicago.
When Kelly and Jacob Blair moved from Austin to Chicago, they had a bit of a culture shock.
In Austin, it was a big deal. You would choose restaurants and bars to go to based on their happy hour specials. And when we moved here, it just seemed like none of them had specials at all.
Because pretty much none of them did, the Blairs, who I found at the bar at Chicago's Roots Handmade Pizza, didn't know that happy hours were banned in Illinois. That is, until they heard the ban had been lifted.
I just found that out from my bartender. I'm excited. There's going to be happy hour in Chicago.
They aren't the only ones excited. Scott Weiner is the co-owner of Roots Handmade Pizza. A lot of Weiner's business depends on sports fans who come in to eat, drink, and watch a game. He says the happy hour ban was hampering his business.
Just doing a special during Monday Night Football, something you couldn't do. Even giving away a drink during halftime when you have, a bad football game.
Bears fans tend to get despondent when their team is losing and leave.
Happy hour law might be a way for us to keep business strong.
This law is a huge step forward for the entire hospitality industry. We've gotten overwhelming support from all over the state.
That's Sam Toya, president of the Illinois Restaurant Association. He's been campaigning to lift the happy hour ban, which also covered food and drink specials like New Year's Eve dinners with unlimited champagne. Toya says the ban made the state less attractive to visitors.
It's all about conventions, tourism, and culinary tourism, and we feel this bill brought us into the 21st century.
But there are still limits. Happy hour is capped at 4 hours a day. Discounts must be advertised a week in advance, and no volume specials like two drinks for the price of one. Seven other states have limits like these. Chris Bazalian, who runs several restaurants and bars in Chicago, says he supports the new law, but he's aware of the pitfalls.
I can remember, in college, quarter beer nights or dollar pitcher nights. And frankly, it just wasn't a good environment. It really did encourage overconsumption.
Bazalian says he's worried some businesses will go back to those kinds of practices. At Roots Handmade Pizza, Scott Weiner says such concerns miss the point of the law.
We're not trying to get people overly served or drunk. We are looking for ways to get more butts in seats.
And to that end, Weiner says he's going to ramp up his marketing efforts, including happy hour specials. In Chicago, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of, man, I'd really like to have one of those, you know? Tesla announced a new feature for its top-of-the-line model today. For a mere $13,000 extra dollars, you can get an electric car that not only looks good, because, come on, they are pretty-looking cars, but also one that goes from 0 to 60 in 2.8 seconds. That's an improvement of 0.4 of a second from the earlier model, or, put another way, $3,250 per tenth of a second. Why are they offering that? Because they can. That's why. All right, we got to go. Look at the time. Out of here. The Dow off 33 points today, nearly 0.2%. The NASDAQ gained 46 points. That is 0.9%. The S&P 500 picked up 2 points, 0.1%. And oh, yeah, Teslas are like $100,000 anyway, so, right? All right, we got to go. Theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Sitar Nieves is the senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you on Monday. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.